Hey, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, and we're in the heart chapter. It's November 19th, a Wednesday. Let's take a look at the schedule real quick. All right, so let me make my way over to the schedule. I'm turning some of these lights down. As I'm walking over there, do we have any announcements from SI?
No.
No announcements. We're good with SI. Great. All right, so like we said, November 19th, where are we? We're right here, Wednesday. We're going to get into blood vessels today. Last time you took your third exam. We're just going to finish up something on the heart just a little bit today. All right, so when is your next exam? Today's the 19th. All right, everybody, let's get together. Who's yakking up there? If you got to really talk about something, go outside, please. Okay? So when is your next exam? It is 1 to 3 weeks from today. So if you have a lab on Wednesday, you have a practicum, the fourth practicum, and your last lecture exam on the same day. That's just the way it goes. The Wednesday group already had an exam, a lecture exam, and a practicum on the same day, so I'm just kind of switching it off a little bit. The chapters on the last exam and lecture are 19 through 25, and it is continuous. Right? We don't drop any of the chapters, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25, indeed. All those chapters are on there. All your study guides should be good. For that last practicum, there are a bunch of videos. There's so many videos, I have to have two folders to put them in. I think I have videos of everything except for the dissection, because it's really hard to show dissections on that video. But I'll try if you guys want to. All right, any questions on the schedule? No questions on the schedule? Fantastic. All right. Any questions over what we talked about last time in terms of the heart? Anything last time regarding the heart? No questions. Well, I guess some of the easy stuff is, how many chambers does the heart have? Nice. How many valves does the heart have? Four. Yeah, you guys don't sound very enthusiastic, but you should because it's so easy, right? Four and four. How many sides does the heart have? Two. Yeah, what are they? Yeah, just the right and left side. And then how many circulations are there in the body? Two, right? It matches up with the sides of the heart. And, of course, you should know what the names of those circulations are. They are the systemic, which goes to everywhere in your body, and then the second one is the pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation is very short, so it does not need the same amount of pressure for blood to move around the pulmonary circulation. So remember, when you look at a heart, here's a nice picture of a heart. When you look at the heart, which ventricle is going to be thicker? Is it very easy to appreciate? Which The left ventricle is going to be a lot thicker, and it is very easy to see that, right? That's a nice check, because the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, which is the proximal artery in the systemic circulation, right? And the systemic circulation is a very high pressure circulation compared to the pulmonary. All right, so that's the heart. Any questions on this illustration here? I think in the study guide, I do ask you to be able to label all of these blood vessels coming off the arch, and even this one that's tucked away down over here as well. Right, it's not labeled on this illustration, but I do want you to be able to pick those out. It's not very difficult, especially when we go over blood vessels a little bit later today. All right, any other questions? That's just a kind of quick review. But in lab, one thing else I want to review, because it's so important, and it's so nice and simple, so easy. Right, when you start to look at a heart, a real dissected heart in lab, how should you always start? Yeah, you got to know three things. The first thing is apex, second thing is base, the widest part of the heart, and then what's the third thing? Anterior longitudinal sulcus, and it's the only sulcus that wraps on a diagonal around the heart. Right, and since it is the anterior longitudinal sulcus, you know what side of the heart this is. Right, this is anterior. So you know this is left, here is right, because this would be like looking at my heart and my body. Right, we're looking right at the anterior side. Okay, so that will really, oh, look at here. These blood vessels are labeled on this illustration. So you can use this as a key to label them on the illustration with a heart that's opened up. Okay, so last time we were talking about the heart And we said that in order for it to pump blood, it's got a heart, it's got to beat as a unit. It's got to contract as one unit. The left side of the heart can't beat while the septum in the right side is relaxed, because that's just going to move blood from the left side over to the right side. Right? And then if the right side contracts and the left is relaxing, then blood is going to slosh over back over to the left. And blood is just going to slosh around inside the heart. We don't want that. Right? We want blood being ejected into the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. In order for that to happen, the heart has to contract as a unit. Sometimes it doesn't happen, and we'll look at a circumstance where that does not happen. So there is a conduction system. There are some special fibers, muscle fibers inside the heart that aren't specialized for contraction. Even though they are muscle, they're specialized to transmit electrical information, almost the same as a nerve, an electrical impulse, a nerve impulse, even though they're a muscle cell. So muscles and nerves, in that sense, are very similar. And you have to know the pieces of that conduction system. And it's way down at the end of the chapter, important exam figure. Right? And remember, cardiac muscle is different than skeletal muscle because it's short and it's branched, right? There are intercalated discs between the muscle fibers, and those intercalated discs just glue the myocardial cells together, but there are also connections so that electrical activity can flow from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. So if one cell in the heart gets excited, the whole heart gets excited because of those things in that intercalated disc. And who remembers what those things are? It's a special kind of synapse, and I heard it back there someplace. It's a gap junction, right? So a gap junction is a synapse, but what kind of synapse is it? It's an electrical synapse. So remember, a synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. We're more familiar with a chemical synapse that uses a neurotransmitter to go across the synaptic cleft, but in an electrical synapse, there is no synaptic cleft. The cells are tightly packed together, and they're actually, the cytosol is connected to each other via a gap junction. All right, so here is the pacemaker of the heart. We call this the sinoatrial node, right? Because it's in the right atrium, very close to where the superior vena cava enters the right atrium. And cardiac muscle, unlike skeletal muscle, is autorhythmic. It will contract by itself at some kind of normal frequency. After a period of time, it's just going to contract. It's going to relax, and then after a period of time, it's going to contract again. And skeletal muscle is not like that. It's not autorhythmic. If you don't excite a skeletal muscle, it will just stay relaxed. And it just so happens that the autorhythmicity of the sinoatrial node is the fastest compared to any other cell inside the heart. So the SA node will be excited first while the rest of the heart is relaxed, but once it gets excited, it's going to pass that excitation through the rest of the heart because of all of those gap junctions. So that's why we call this the pacemaker. So it controls the rate of the whole heart, if it's a nice normal heart, because this has the fastest rate of activation. Right? But when it becomes excited, it just tells the whole heart to become excited and then contract. So here is the SA node. And these arrows represent that flow of electrical information from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. And both atria, both the right and left atrium, become excited. And when they get excited, then they contract. All right, so the both atria contract together because that electrical signal travels very, very fast. They contract together, but the ventricles don't contract at the exact same time. Almost, but not quite. That electrical signal, before it gets down into the ventricles, has to pass through the AV node. Here's the atrioventricular node, and that holds on to that electrical signal for a brief period of time, maybe about 100 milliseconds or a tenth of a second, and then it passes the electrical signal down through the atrioventricular bundle, down to the bundle branches, and then down to the apex of the heart very rapidly. So the AV node slows that electrical impulse down. The bundle branches in the AV bundle right here speed it up. It just zips down to the apex, and then that excitation leaves the conduction system via these Purkinje fibers, and that excites all the myocardial cells to contract. So the atria contract first, there's a delay, then both ventricles contract as a result of that electrical activity getting down into the ventricles. And also the ventricles have to contract in a certain way. All right, we see the valves are up by the base of the heart. Right here is the aortic valve. That looks like the aorta right here. Don't see the pulmonary semilunar valve, but it would be about in this location. All right, if the basal regions of the ventricles contracted before this, what region is the cursor on right now? Yeah, this is the apical region right here, is the basal region. But if the basal regions contracted first before the apex, then blood would be forced down toward the apex, to the inferior part of the heart. It wouldn't be ejected from the heart. So it is best that the apex contracts first, right, and then the free wall starts to contract, and then finally the best basilar regions here contract, and so that forces blood from the apical region up to where the great arteries are and then out of the heart. And that's the other reason for this conduction system. Okay, because that electrical impulse moves through the interventricular septum very quickly, and it excites the apical regions of the heart first. They contract, that forces blood up to the basal regions, right? And then the basal regions contract, and that squirts blood out of the heart. All right, but nonetheless, you should think of the heart as contracting as a unit because of those gap junctions. But there still is a little coordination between the atria and the ventricles, and even within the ventricles, and that conduction system is necessary for that to take place. There is a fibrous skeleton, right, that separates the atria from the ventricles, and that fibrous skeleton is connective tissue. It does not have gap junctions, so the atria are isolated from the ventricles electrically. So if you were to excite the atria over here, it does not necessarily mean that the ventricles will become excited, because there is no pathway for that electrical signal to move into a ventricle except through the AV node, right, and the atrial ventricular bundle. That's the only way electrical signals can get down into the ventricles. In some circumstances, when somebody has a heart attack, they might have an area of ischemia or infarction, which means dead tissue, right in this region where there is the AV node or the AV bundle. And when that happens, that electrical impulse from the atria can't get down into the ventricles because that part of the conduction system is now dead. And like I said, it can't get through the fibrous skeleton of the heart because there are no gap junctions there. So you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, does that mean that the ventricles don't contract if there's no way for an electrical signal to move from the atria down into the ventricles? So what happens to somebody in that circumstance? Okay, the atria are still contracting. They're still controlled by the SA node. But what about the ventricles? What did we say about all muscle cells? They are autorhythmic. They have a tendency just to contract all by themselves. The ventricles will contract at a slower rate compared to the SA node. Right, so the atria will contract relatively rapidly, right, and the ventricles then will contract at a slower pace, and it's going to be independent of the atria. Right, so the atria will contract by themselves, but both together, and then both ventricles will contract, but that coordination between the atria and ventricles is lost if there's no way to get through the fibrous skeleton. That's usually not too big a deal, because what chambers are the major pumps of the heart? Are they the atria or the ventricles? And you could just look at the thickness of the wall. Yeah, the ventricles, right, are doing most of the work, pumping blood through the systemic and pulmonary circulations. And as a matter of fact, the atria, because they are so weak, right, only help fill the ventricles a little bit. They're really of no significance whatsoever, right? So it doesn't really matter if the atria contract at a different rhythm compared to the ventricles, because the atria in normal circumstances are not too important, right, except for it contains the pacemaker. But they still should contract a little bit. The problem that might arise when there is loss of coordination between the atria and ventricles, or if the atria start to misbehave, right, maybe blood has a tendency to pool in an atrium, because it can't get into a ventricle, And then that is very dangerous because when blood stops moving, it has a tendency to turn from a liquid into a solid. What do we call that when blood turns into a solid from a liquid? We call that coagulation, or forming a blood clot, right? And then, of course, that blood clot could travel anywhere. It could travel into the heart and cause a heart attack. It could go into the brain and cause a stroke. Or maybe even could go into a lung and cause a pulmonary embolism. Either of those are fatal circumstances, right? Or certainly could be. All right, so if somebody is having trouble with atria, maybe they're not contracting properly, then they have to be on anticoagulants like Coumadin, right, would be a really good example of something. So that will prevent coagulation of blood in the ventricles. All right, so that's a little bit of important physiology. So make sure you know all of these structures. So what are the structures? SA node, right, AV node, AV bundle, the bundle branches, right? And then finally, these Purkinje fibers. And the Purkinje fibers is that last distribution point that excites all of the cells inside the heart. But don't forget, between every muscle cell, there's a gap junction anyway. So the whole heart will contract as a unit. There is a condition, right? If if the heart becomes metabolically unstable, maybe some of the blood vessels are cut off, and blood and oxygen isn't reaching part of the heart, this coordination system is lost. And remember, this part of the heart will be autarrhythmic by itself compared to the SA node. And if for some reason it has a rapid rate of excitation of the ventricle, maybe the same as the SA node, then it's going to act as a pacemaker in some strange part of the heart. We call that an ectopic pacemaker. Right? And when that happens, it is possible for, because of all those gap junctions, for electrical signals, right, instead of going from the atrium down to the apex and then through both ventricles, they start to wander around in the heart because there are gap junctions between all of those cells. And as that electrical signal wanders around in the heart, then some little strip of the heart is going to contract while the rest is relaxed. Right, and then a neighboring strip is going to contract while the rest of the heart is relaxed. And so we call that fibrillation. All right, so just watch my hands. All right, so in lab I said the ventricles contract with a lot of force, a lot of vigor, right? They go boom, boom, like that. All right, and the atria kind of contract like this. They hardly contract at all, real, real weak. If somebody has fibrillation, the heart is not contracting strongly, it's just kind of doing this. Right, so, and when that happens, blood is not being pumped from the heart during fibrillation. And, of course, that could be very dangerous because blood isn't being pumped to your brain. How long will you have consciousness when your heart goes into ventricular fibrillation? Because blood is not going to your brain. How long do you have when your heart goes into fibrillation? About 2 seconds, right? Because that's what we said. Because without oxygen, your brain can't make ATP. There's enough ATP up there for about 2 seconds worth of activity. Right? And then if the heart doesn't start beating normally again, when does your brain die? All right, you lose consciousness in 2 seconds, but when does your brain die? And remember, when your brain's dead, can't come back to life. Right? That's an irreversible process. How long do you have when your heart is fibrillating before your brain actually dies? It's about 2 to 3 minutes, right? So 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, 2 to 3 minutes, somebody's brain dead. And what's really handy, some people have figured out a way how to help somebody's heart beat if it's not beating for itself normally. And so I'm sure some of you are trained in this kind of technique. What is it called? Yeah, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And how would you help somebody's heart beat if it is just fibrillating? How do we get some blood to somebody's brain? Yeah, chest compressions, right? Pushing down on the sternum, that compresses the heart, and because of the valves in the heart, blood is still going to go through the heart in the correct direction. It won't go backwards, right? So blood will go from a ventricle into an artery, and that might be just enough oxygen going to the brain. You might be pumping just enough blood to a person's brain to keep it from dying, right? It probably won't be enough blood to where they wake up, to where they become conscious, but it might just keep that brain alive until their heart can be revived with a defibrillator. Some of these machines are around. I don't know where there's one on campus, but there's one or more than one at the fire station just a half a block away. Disneyland has them all over the place. They're called automatic electronic defibrillators, AEDs. And probably those of you that are CPR certified have some training on those devices as well. Okay. All right, so when you start CPR on somebody and you do chest compressions and they don't wake up, is it a good idea just to stop CPR? No, because what are you doing and you don't notice? You might be just keeping their brain alive, right, so that when they are resuscitated with a defibrillator, they can regain consciousness. So don't ever quit, right? Even if you're there for 5 minutes before paramedics come and help you, and it's kind of hard. Unless you exercise regularly, it's hard for you to do chest compressions. But don't give up, right? Keep doing it, especially for me. Never give up, okay? Okay, and if you want to tell me never give up on you, I'll listen to you. We can have a little pact, okay? All right, so fibrillation, no coordination of contraction because that synchronized depolarization, what that depolarization means is an electrical stimulus, right? That's just a fancy way that we talk about an electrical stimulus in a physiology class. So that's okay if you hear this word right now, even though you don't really know what's happening. Okay. Here is something else. All right. We don't have any somatic motor neurons going to the heart. You don't have control of your heart. Your autonomic nervous system does. All right. So we don't have somatic motor fibers going to the heart, but we do have nerve fibers from the autonomic nervous system. So how many divisions are you aware of that the autonomic nervous system has? Yeah, it has two. What's the relationship between those two divisions? They're antagonistic, right? And so you might think, but you guys don't think this anymore, that it might be silly to have antagonistic control if you have one system that excites and another that inhibits because they'll cancel each other out and you'll have nothing, right? But that's really not how it works, right? If you have antagonistic control, you actually have precise control and balance because these two systems keep each other in check. All right, so the heart does have parasympathetic fibers and sympathetic fibers going to it. The parasympathetic fibers go to the SA node and inhibit the SA node. That will slow the heart rate down. So parasympathetic slows the heart rate down, and that's the only place where the parasympathetic nervous system goes, which is kind of strange, only the SA node, and maybe some of the conduction tissues over here, but still in the atria. The sympathetic nervous system goes to the SA node, and it excites the SA node, and it causes an increase in heart rate, so it speeds the heart up. But sympathetic fibers also go to the ventricles, to the myocardium, and it doesn't speed up the heart rate there, but what it does on those cells, it makes those cells contract with more force. All right, so not only with sympathetic stimulation, not only does the heart rate get faster, but your heart beats much more strongly as well. All right, so that's kind of strange. Parasympathetic nervous system only goes to the atria, but the sympathetic nervous system goes to both the atria and the ventricles. So you only have that nice antagonistic control over your heart rate, but not force of contraction, which I think is kind of too bad. Because what would the parasympathetic nervous system do on the ventricles? If the sympathetic causes the myocardium to beat with more force, what would the parasympathetic do? It would make the heart beat with less force. Okay, and there's a condition in the United States and pretty much all over the world that's epidemic, and that is high blood pressure. Does anybody know what high blood pressure is? What's a term for that, clinical term? It's called hypertension, right? Well, because you only have sympathetic nerves that go to the heart that increase the force of contraction that will increase your blood pressure, right? That's a problem because you don't have parasympathetic nerves going to the heart to decrease the force of contraction to bring your blood pressure back down, right? So that is, I think you should probably make a connection with that physiology. Because you lose antagonistic control of the ventricles, right, the only autonomic response is for the heart to beat stronger to increase your blood pressure. So it would be nice if there was a break, right, to slow or to decrease the force of contraction if somebody's blood pressure got too high. But We don't have a nervous system that will do that. All right, so that's it. Oh, you don't have to, I'm not going to test you on these, but I think it's a good idea for you to know something. When we think of a chronotropic effect, that is an effect on the heart that changes the heart rate. All right, so sometimes people wear a chronograph on their wrist. What's a chronograph? It's a watch. It's just a wrist watch. So anytime you hear this term chrono, you should think of time or rate. Okay? And we see that the parasympathetic nervous system only can adjust the rate of the heart, but not force of contraction, so it has a chronotropic effect. But the sympathetic nervous system can adjust the heart rate, so it has a chronotropic effect. But it also can affect the force of contraction, and we call that inotropy, inotropic. So the way your heart works or maintains blood pressure is by two things, the rate at which it contracts and the force of contraction. All right, so rate is always chrono, the force is inotropy. So that's going to be important when you get to physiology. You don't have to know that in this class, but when you hear those terms in physiology, I want you to remember, oh, somewhere along the line, I learned what those things were. So that it's not too freaky when you hear of it again. All right, so that's it for the heart. Anybody have any questions on the heart? Okay. What's the number one leading cause of death in females? Anybody know? I should have started out with this. It's a heart attack. We think it only happens to males, but that's not true. Okay? It's the number one leading cause of death in females and probably males as well. So it's really good for you to know everything about the heart that you can possibly imagine. All right, so let's move to the next topic, which is going to be the vasculature, blood vessels. All right, so we see blood vessels right. Oh, did I close the wrong one down? No. I'm good. All right, so get out your notes for blood vessels. Okay, I wish I could have talked about this earlier on in the semester, especially before the endocrinology chapter, because we talked a lot about blood vessels. You had to know something about capillaries and a portal blood vessel, and now is where you can actually learn something about this, other than just memorizing. All right, so a blood vessel is responsible for carrying blood from one part of your body to another. Remember, blood is a connective tissue, so it connects various parts of your body. So it connects your lungs with your brain, your lungs with your heart. So blood picks up oxygen in the lungs and delivers it to all these other organs that need oxygen. So that's one way that we can think of it as a connective tissue. So that's one important function of blood. There are cells in blood called erythrocytes or red blood cells, and their job is to pick up oxygen in the lungs and release that oxygen in tissues. That's their whole job. And there's a chemical inside red blood cells that picks up that oxygen that's called hemoglobin. And there's so much hemoglobin in a red blood cell that there's not even room for a nucleus or organelles. So a red blood cell is kind of funny because it's a nucleate. It doesn't have a nucleus. Right, it's just loaded with hemoglobin to carry oxygen for us. All right, so oxygen travels through these different vessels. And what is the name of a vessel that takes blood away from the heart called? An artery. What do we call a vessel that brings blood back to the heart? A vein, right? And that has nothing to do with if it's high in oxygen or low in oxygen. It's only the direction of blood flow. All right, so we know what arteries and veins are. There's one other kind of blood vessel, and we see it on this slide over here, and that is a place where things can either enter or leave the blood, and that's a capillary. Okay, so an artery, the function of an artery is to take blood away from the heart. The function of a vein is to bring blood back to the heart, and the function of a capillary is exchange. Right? So if anything is in the blood and that blood is in an artery, it's stuck there. Can't go anywhere. Right? It's just going to be in blood. Right? If there's something in blood that's in a vein, again, it can't go anywhere. It's stuck in that vein. But if there's something in the capillary, what can it do? It can leave, right? It can go into tissue spaces. or if there's something in tissue spaces, it can move into a capillary, and it does that by diffusion. That means that if there's a concentration gradient, that compound will go from high concentration to low. And so there's high oxygen in this capillary, low oxygen in the tissues, then oxygen is going to leave the blood and go into tissues down this concentration gradient. All right, and this is why we see that an artery has many layers to it. It's way too thick to allow for diffusion. And the same thing for a vein. Look at all these layers in a vein, way too thick. Something can't diffuse across all these layers. But what about layers of a capillary? They're very, very thin, and there's only one layer, right? So things can diffuse across this layer. We call this an endothelium. It's an epithelium, but since it lines the inside of this tube, we call it an endothelium. All right, so it's really important to know all of these different layers because these layers can be affected by disease processes, and it's going to change the way blood flows through them, or maybe it can cause blood clots, or maybe it can cause a spasm and cut off blood supply. All right, so we're really interested in all these layers. When we get to the digestive system, you'll see that's true. And for sure, when we looked at skin, that was true. All right, so now we're going to pay attention to some layers. There are three main layers in a blood vessel, at least for arteries and veins. All right, on the outside, we call it the tunica externa. And remember, a tunic is just a covering or coat. Think of a tunic as a coat. And so here's the tunica externa. You see that it's made up of collagen fibers. What kind of fiber is a collagen fiber? It's really strong, right? It's the strongest fiber there is, right? And the pressure in an artery is a lot higher than a vein, so the tunica externa is more extensive in an artery than a vein that has more collagen fibers. And that just helps this blood vessel from enlarging, from dilating, or even ripping apart if it is a nice healthy layer. Not guaranteed all the time. Right, the next layer, tunica media, has a number of different things in it. It has smooth muscle, so I see a nice big thick layer of smooth muscle, and it also has some elastic tissue. Oh, so that muscle right here makes the wall of this artery really nice and strong. It can contract and dilate a little bit, and this elastic layer right here means that an artery can expand, and as some blood flows out of it, what happens to the shape or size of that artery? It goes back down to its original shape. Okay? So this elasticity here allows for a big bolus of blood to move through, like when your heart contracts, right? That blood is squirted out of the heart, and these blood vessels expand a little bit, and then when your heart goes into relaxation, then the blood vessels shrink back down to their normal diameter. Right, when we look at a vein, look how thin the smooth muscle layer is, right? And it doesn't even have this elastic component. So veins, when we look at them, when we do a dissection in lab on our fetal pigs, we'll see there's a big difference between arteries and veins. Arteries will be big and thick and tough, and veins will be relatively thin and flaccid because it's missing some of these layers. All right, so that's the tunica media. Then the tunica intima, or the innermost layer. Well, we said the innermost, deepest layer right here is that endothelium, right, which is an epithelium that lines the inside space of this artery and also the vein and also a capillary. All right, it's really an epithelium. And how would you classify this endothelium? Right, if you want to think of it in terms of an epithelium, which is okay, right, how do we classify an epithelium? Two ways. What are two ways? The number of layers, right? You either have simple or you have stratified. And then also by the shape of the cells, right? You can have cuboidal, columnar, or squamous. So when you look at these cells right here, right, do they look like? Well, they look like squamous cells. They're flat. And how many layers do you see? One. So this is a simple squamous epithelium, right? And so simple squamous epithelium is specialized to allow for exchange. We're going to see simple squamous epithelium, like in the lungs, for instance, as well. All right, and this endothelium should be nice and smooth and slippery so that blood slides over it without causing blood clots. Okay, and if there's disease in any of these layers right here that damages the endothelium, and then that blood vessel has a tendency to produce blood clots that can go and cause strokes or embolisms, right, or heart attacks. So that's one reason why we want to be really familiar with all these different layers. Underneath the endothelium, there's a subendothelial layer, right, which is just connective tissue, and there might even be some elastic tissue in some arteries as well that helps them expand and then contract back down to their normal diameter after blood passes through them. All right, so here are the three layers. Externa. Okay, and as a matter of fact, in some blood vessels, this tunica externa is so thick that it has to have its own blood supply. And you know what? I see it on this slide right here. I see some blue and red dots. All right, so here is a blood supply even within a blood vessel if it's a thick, really strong artery. We call that the vasa vasorum, the blood supply even within a blood vessel. Okay, tunica media, we talked about the circular muscle and the elastic tissue, the tunica intima, the endothelium, and then connective tissue layers and maybe sometimes elastic tissue. All right, so these are the three main kinds of blood vessels. You have artery, capillary, and vein. And in most circumstances in your body, you have an artery, one capillary bed, and then a vein. When we looked at the endocrine system between the hypothalamus and the pituitary, we saw an artery, a capillary, a length of blood vessel, and a second capillary before it went into a vein, right? And that little second, the first capillary bed was in the hypothalamus, the second capillary bed was in the pituitary, and this connecting piece was called a portal blood vessel, right? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel, right? And now you get to see where that is. When we're almost done with this chapter, I'll show you another picture of what a portal system looks like. It's just a special delivery system that takes things from one capillary bed directly to the second capillary without going other places in the body. Okay, so why does exchange happen only in a capillary and nowhere else? Because the capillary is thin. That's right, that's the only reason that allows for diffusion. All of these other vessels are way too thick to allow for diffusion, right? And that's because they have to be stronger. Arteries have to be stronger because there's high pressure in them. All right, so there's blood in these vessels. How does that blood know to move from one area to another? Why is blood flowing through these vessels? I didn't mention that, but we certainly got to mention that. Maybe I did when we talked about the heart, because that's the job of the heart. Right. Blood is a liquid, which is a fluid. Okay, gas, the air in this room is a fluid as well. It will move. How will this air in the room move? Or how will blood move through a blood vessel? It will always go depending on the pressure. There has to be a pressure gradient. Blood will always flow from an area of high pressure to low pressure. Right. So, for instance, if you think of your car tire, you know that there's high pressure inside that car tire. And if you open up the valve or you put a hole in your tire, which way is air going to go? Yeah, it's going to go out from high pressure to low. And it's the job of the heart to generate high pressure so that blood flows from the heart into a vein where there's low blood pressure. And in so doing, it's got to go through this area of exchange that we call a capillary. Okay. All right, so you see these three kinds of blood vessels. Let me see what else we got here. Got some histology. Okay, that's good for now. All right, let's talk a little bit more about some subclassifications of blood vessels. Here we talked about arteries, and what is a definition of an artery that always works? Takes blood away from the heart. Okay, and remember, it could be oxygenated or relatively deoxygenated, and probably right now you should be able to tell me of an artery that is relatively low in oxygen. This is a strange one, right? Because you haven't thought about this one before you took an anatomy class, probably. What kind of artery is low in oxygen? For instance, and I heard it, that's great. That's the pulmonary artery. It's an artery because it's taking the blood away from the heart, right? But it is to the lungs, right? So that pulmonary artery is low in oxygen because it's taking blood to the lungs to pick up oxygen, right? So that's an artery that's low. What's an artery that's high in oxygen? The aorta, right. And right, so the pulmonary artery is part of the pulmonary circulation, the aorta is part of the systemic circulation. So the pulmonary arteries are low in oxygen, the systemic arteries are high in oxygen. Okay. All right, arteries have the highest pressure compared to other blood vessels. And that makes perfect sense because we don't want blood to flow into an artery. We want blood to flow from an artery into other blood vessels. Right? So blood will flow from arteries into other blood vessels if they have the highest pressure. And indeed, that is true. Right? Very large arteries that are close to the heart are called conducting arteries. And they have an elastic component to them. And that's because when the heart beats, it pumps a whole bunch of blood into the artery, and the artery, the aorta, has to expand. Right? And then when the heart relaxes, like I said before, then that artery goes back to its original diameter. Other arteries that are farther away from the heart, right, we call them distributing arteries. They don't have much elastic component to them, but they do have a lot of smooth muscle. Right, so their job is to take blood, right, and distribute it to other places all over the body. That is their major job. And because they have smooth muscle, sometimes when that smooth muscle relaxes, the diameter of an artery can get larger. We call that vasodilation. Right, when that smooth muscle contracts, then the diameter of a blood vessel gets smaller. We call that vasoconstriction. And it's the sympathetic nervous system that causes blood vessels to vasoconstrict. And that vasodilation and vasoconstriction is a very important way to control where blood goes in your body. You don't have enough blood to go everywhere at one time. There's just not enough blood to do that. So your body has to pick where it's going to go. So for instance, when you're in a fed state right after a meal, where should blood go? Yeah, to your digestive system, right? And when you're exercising, where should blood go? To muscles, to skeletal muscles, right? And you probably knew this back when you were just a five-year-old, because what did your mother always tell you? So there was a swimming pool over here, or there was a lake, or there was the ocean. And what do little kids, including all of you, what do you always do if there's a pool there? Even if it's 20 degrees outside, you want to go swimming. Okay, but what did your mom say? Could you go swimming right after lunch? No, because why? There's not enough blood in your body to go to your digestive tract right after lunch and to skeletal muscles at the same time. So that right after lunch, if you started to exercise swimming, you might get a muscle cramp because there's not enough blood to supply all your muscles with the right nutrients and oxygen. And if you have a muscle cramp and you're walking down the sidewalk, it's just painful, just hurts like hell. But it's not fatal, right? But if you have a big painful muscle cramp when you're swimming and that muscle cramp is so strong to where you can't keep your head above water, then what happens? Well, then you drown, right? So that's something very important to consider. All right, so you don't have enough blood to go everywhere in your body. Your body picks where it goes by either vasodilating or vasoconstricting blood vessels. And here is a really important law of physics. And we call it the fourth power rule, right? If the diameter of a blood vessel changes, what happens to the blood flow through that particular blood vessel? All right, well, let's just say, and why don't you cross off radius right here and put diameter. They're almost the same thing, but not quite, but put diameter. All right, let's start off with normal circumstances, and we're just going to say that the diameter of a blood vessel is 1, and we're going to measure blood flow, and we're going to say that it's 1, right? But let's double. Right, we're going to vasodilate this blood vessel. Let's double the diameter. What happens to blood flow? Does it double? If we double the diameter, what happens to blood flow through that blood vessel? According to the fourth power rule, right, it doesn't double, but it doubles again, and then doubles again. So what is that? That's 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, times 2 is 16, so the blood flow changes by a factor of 16. All right, so, and then if the diameter triples, what happens to blood flow? It goes up 81 times. All right, so very small changes in the diameter of a blood vessel produces huge changes in blood flow through to that particular organ. And that's the major way that blood flow is controlled through various parts of your body, just by vasoconstriction or vasodilation. that's an important rule to know. All right, after blood flows out of artery, then it will flow into small arteries that we call arterioles. And they have a lot of smooth muscle. They can vasoconstrict and vasodilate a lot. So that means that arterioles really control where the majority of blood flows in our body because of all that smooth muscle. Let's take a look at this figure right here. Nice. All right, so I see an artery taking blood away from the heart. What circulation is this? What circulation are we looking at right here? This artery happens to be red, which means high in oxygen. Yeah, so it's a nice systemic circulation, right? Here's a relatively deoxygenated blood in this vein, so we know this is systemic circulation. So here's a big artery. Here's a small artery. What do we call a small artery? Arteriole. All right. When it vasoconstricts, it's going to cut off blood supply to this capillary. When it vasodilates, then blood is going to flow through this capillary, bringing in oxygen and nutrients and taking away waste products and washing away carbon dioxide to this particular tissue. So that's the job of this arteriole, right? And what controls that smooth muscle is chemicals, or are chemicals that are floating around in the spaces between cells. Right, so let's just say that this is a muscle cell and it's relaxed. Muscle cells that are relaxed don't need a lot of oxygen because they're not contracting. Muscle cells that aren't contracting don't produce a lot of CO2. And muscles that aren't contracting don't use a lot of glucose. They don't produce a lot of lactic acid. Right? And so when there is high oxygen, when the acidity of this area is normal, then it's going to cause contraction of this arteriole. And when that happens, you don't have a lot of blood going through the capillary, right? But that's when the muscle is relaxed. What happens when that muscle starts to contract and exercise? What happens to that oxygen concentration? It decreases because it's being used up, right? And what kind of compound does a muscle produce if it's using up oxygen? It produces CO2, carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide will work on these muscle cells here to cause them to relax, right? And when they relax, what happens to blood flow through that vessel? When the muscle relaxes, that increases blood flow. And when is that? That's when a muscle is exercising. All right, so the flow through a capillary is determined mostly by the activity within that tissue. Right, and we call that local control. Right, so when the tissues produce a compound that regulates vasoconstriction or dilation, we call that local or intrinsic control, and a lot of areas in your body are controlled that way by the metabolism in that tissue that a capillary serves. If that muscle is producing a lot of CO2, that causes relaxation. If it produces a lot of lactic acid, it causes relaxation. That opens up blood flow to that muscle so that it can keep functioning under local control. All right, so then we have the capillary. What's the function of these capillaries right here? Exchange, and why is that? Because they're thin. All right, at the entrance to every capillary, there's another smooth muscle. All right, and a circular smooth muscle, we're going to call a sphincter, and it acts like a gate. When it constricts, it cuts off blood supply. When it dilates, it allows blood to flow through a capillary, and it works the same way, right? It's under intrinsic control. And when carbon dioxide builds up or acids build up like lactic acid, it causes relaxation of this muscle, and blood flows through a capillary, bringing in oxygen and getting rid of that lactic acid so that, for instance, that muscle can keep contracting. That's what we call local control. And that is due to this precapillary sphincter, okay, that kind of guards the entrance to a capillary. And remember, all over your body, you can't have all these capillaries open at one time because we don't have enough blood to go there. If that happens, our blood pressure would just drop and we couldn't even maintain consciousness, right? So most capillaries in our body are closed most of the time. Okay, capillary, smallest blood vessel, right? Just a single layer. It's specialized for exchange. And it just so happens that we have three kinds of capillaries in our body. And it's important that you know these three kinds, especially when you get into a physiology class. So let me see if I can show you the three kinds of capillaries. Here we go. Really close. All right, so what kind of blood vessel am I showing you right here? What kind of blood? Your choices will be artery, capillary, or vein. That's a capillary. How do you know this is a capillary? Yeah, because it only has the endothelial layer, right? There's no tunica externa, no tunica media, just the endothelium, which is what? A simple squamous epithelium. This one is the usual kind of capillary. We call this a continuous capillary. It has some spaces between the cells, right? We call that an intracellular cleft or intercellular cleft. So some fluid can leak out between these spaces of the endothelium, but these spaces are so small that what about this red blood cell? Can this red blood cell squeeze through there? It cannot, right? Only very small molecules like water, maybe glucose, oxygen, carbon dioxide can squeeze through here, no problem, right? And so this is a capillary that allows for exchange, but a minimal amount compared to the other two that we're going to look at. All right, we find this in skin and muscle would be good examples. All right, now what about this capillary? You agree that this is still a capillary? Is this a capillary? Yeah, because it still has only an endothelium. But now the intercellular clefts are a little bit larger, right? But what else do we see? We see that there are actually pores that go through the endothelium that are contained within each of these cells that make up the endothelium. I see one right here. We call these fenestrations or pores. Another way that you can think of a fenestration is a window, right? So here is like a foramen that actually is going through the cell. So this kind of capillary you think is more leaky or less leaky compared to the first one or the continuous that we looked at? More, yeah, because it has more pores. More molecules can leak out of this capillary, right? And so we find this one where we want to have a lot of exchange, super exchange. A good example of an organ that does that is the kidney, right? And even the small intestine. But in the kidney, right, that fluid that leaks out is processed to become urine. So they have to have special leaky capillaries in the kidney. And those are what we call fenestrated capillaries. Well, there's one more kind of capillary, right? And here it is here. And it hardly looks like a capillary, but could you tell that this is a capillary and why? Well, there's a red blood cell right there, so it's a blood vessel. So the choice would be artery, capillary, or vein. And I only still see a simple squamous endothelium, so it is a capillary, but now it has these big pores, right, within the endothelium. It has super large intercellular clefts, and so this is a very, very leaky capillary, so a lot of the fluid part of blood that we call plasma, right, can leak out very easily, and even the basement membrane is incomplete. It's not continuous, so things can even leak out through the basement membrane much more easily, and so this is what we call a sinusoidal capillary in organs, where blood has to trickle through the spaces between cells of the organ, have this kind of capillary, and an organ where that happens is the liver. Right? So you have a lot of blood products floating through the spaces between cells in the liver because they have sinusoidal capillaries. Same thing for spleen and bone marrow. Bone marrow and spleen have similar kinds of processes going on in them, right, for immune response, so I would expect them to have kind of the same capillaries in them. All right, so what are the three kinds of capillaries? We've got continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. And which one is the most leaky? Sinusoidal. And which is the least leaky? Continuous, right? And so the function of these capillaries is different, right? The function of a continuous capillary is different than the function of a sinusoidal capillary. So if the function is different, what else could you tell me about these capillaries? Ah, perfect. The structure has to be different if they have a different function, right? And now you're a little familiar with what the difference in structure is and how that relates to the function. All right, so we talked about arterioles. Venules are small veins that collect blood. all right, from a capillary. And, all right, going back to this slide. So here is a venule. It's collecting blood from a capillary bed, and that flows into a vein. Right? And then a vein does what? Brings blood back to the heart. All right, so veins bring blood back to the heart, maybe oxygenated or deoxygenated. Give me an example. Here's a really tricky question. Give me an example of a vein that is high in oxygen. Where's that going to be? Oh, I heard it right off the bat. A pulmonary vein, right? Pulmonary vein is bringing blood back from the lungs toward the heart, so it's a vein. It's bringing blood back to the heart. And since it has just been to the lungs, it has picked up oxygen, so it is high in oxygen. So in the pulmonary circulation, veins are high in oxygen. In the systemic circulation, veins are low in oxygen. Right? So they're opposite to each other. Veins have the lowest blood pressure. And is that a good thing? Why do veins have to have a low blood pressure compared to a capillary or an artery? Yeah, because that pressure determines where blood is flowing. It's going to flow from an artery and a capillary into a vein so that it can go back to the heart. So if capillaries had the lowest blood pressure, where would all the blood flow to? It'd flow into a capillary, and it would stay there. It wouldn't go back to the heart, right? So veins have to have the lowest pressure so that blood flows through the circulation, doesn't get trapped someplace. All right, but since there is low blood pressure in a vein, blood does have a little bit of trouble making its way back to the heart because it has such low blood pressure. But there are some structures in a vein. Let's take a look. There are some structures in a vein, okay, that help blood flow back. So here is a vein. Very low blood pressure, right? So that blood flows from an artery through the capillaries into this vein. And it's going to flow back to the heart. And I see a structure. I see a specialization of the endothelium that we see in a vein that I do not see in a capillary and I do not see in an artery. What structure do you see in a vein that you don't see anywhere else? Yeah, valve. You told me already 5 times. But I was listening to you even though I kept talking. Okay. Here is a valve. All right. And so what's the job of a valve? To make sure that blood flows in only one direction. Veins have valves, so blood, right, when it flows back to the heart, will cause these leaflets to lie up against the wall of the endothelium. When blood starts to flow backwards, then these things puff up, just like a semilunar valve or an AV valve, and that prevents the retrograde flow of blood. All right, so the blood will want to flow backwards under some circumstances. Right? For instance, if this vein is in a muscle, okay, and we contract the muscle, and this part of the vein is in that muscle that's contracting, right? That vein is being squeezed down. It will have high pressure, right? And it will want to squirt back down to your extremity, but it can't because here's a vein. Where is it going to squirt to? It's going to squirt back up to the heart, right? So muscle contraction is a way that we can pressurize blood in our veins so that it keeps squirting back to our heart. We call that the skeletal muscle pump. All right, so exercising muscle is a way to help our circulatory system work. All right, if this blood vessel is diseased, okay, the vein can actually increase in diameter to where these valve leaflets can no longer touch each other. They'll just kind of flop back and forth. And when this part of the blood vessel is pressurized, then blood will flow past this valve because it's going to flop down over here. Right? And so blood will have a tendency to pool in these blood vessels right here. And I think you've probably seen this in some people. It's really easy to observe in superficial veins, right, where some of their veins are really super dilated because these valves aren't working anymore. What kind of veins do we call those? Varicose veins. Right? And so the integrity of these veins has to be maintained to make sure that these valves work in veins, and actually these valves are really easy to see in some people, right? If I were to squeeze muscles in my forearm, I can see like little knots along some veins that are superficial. What are those little knots? Those little bulges are these valves that are working to prevent blood from going back down to my hand. It's making sure that it goes back to my heart. Okay, so veins have these valves, and blood returns to the heart by that skeletal muscle pump, Okay? But also something else, something we call the respiratory pump. And this might sound strange, but not after you think about it. Okay, so you know your thoracic cavity. Sometimes air flows in, sometimes air flows out. And air is a fluid. Why does air flow in? So it has something to do with pressure. We're going to look at that when we get to lungs. All right? Air flows into your lungs when the pressure in your lungs is lower than the air pressure, right? Because an air pressure forces air into your lungs, and your lungs act like a vacuum cleaner, right? Like that. Okay, when does air flow out? When the pressure in your lungs is higher than the air, like when you compress your thoracic cavity, air flows out. Okay. Well, when you decrease the pressure in your thoracic cavity and you allow air to flow in, right, like that, you have low pressure in your thorax. Not only does the fluid air flow into your lungs, but what else? There's another fluid that flows into your thoracic cavity. What's another fluid? We were just talking about it. And that is blood. So every time you inhale, not only does that help suck air into your lungs, but it helps suck blood from your extremity back into your thoracic cage. And what is there in your thoracic cavity? That's where your heart is, right? So every time you breathe, that helps return blood to your heart, and that's what we call the respiratory pump. So these are two mechanisms that move blood, okay, back to your heart, even though it has really, really low blood pressure, really, really low pressure. But in order for that to happen, veins have to have these valves, right? Because muscles relax. You're not always inhaling. You can't inhale constantly. Sometimes you have to exhale. When you exhale, that's going to force blood out of your thoracic cavity. But since you have these valves, it can't go back as long as they're working normally. All right, so valves are important. Let's look at some anatomy of the pulmonary and systemic circulation, right? And I think you're aware that there are these two circulations in the body. Pulmonary circulation, I got a couple pictures. Here is an example of a couple skeletal muscles that are contracting, right? And when they contract, they bulge, they press on this blood vessel. And what kind of blood vessel is this? Pretend you're colorblind and pretend you can't read. Okay, what kind of blood vessel is this? Is it a vein or an artery? Yeah, how do you know this is a vein? Because it has valves, right? Because it has valves. You see that structure right there? And these valves are oriented such that blood can only flow from bottom to top. So when these skeletal muscles contract, it's going to pressurize blood in this one little segment compared to the one down here and one above. So blood is going to want to flow down back to the extremity or flow up to the heart, and it can only flow in one direction because this valve right here closes. It can't flow back down to the extremity, so blood is going to move back to the heart. Right? And then when these muscles relax, the blood up in this segment will want to flow back down, but will blood be able to flow back down from this top segment to this segment around these muscles? It can't, because here's a valve that will prevent that from happening. So blood will just make its way through all these different segments back up to the heart. So is this an example of the skeletal muscle pump or respiratory pump? Skeletal muscle pump, right? Okay. All right. I think a little bit earlier on today, I mentioned that blood is a fluid, right? But if it's standing still, what can happen to blood? It can coagulate, right? It can turn into a solid. All right. So what can happen if these valves aren't working, or if you don't exercise, these skeletal muscles right here? What happens to blood in this vein if you don't exercise these skeletal muscles? Then it might just stay in this part of the vein. And if it just stays in this part of the vein, what can happen to it? It can coagulate, right? It should stay a nice fluid, right? And that actually happens to some people when they're immobilized for a long period of time. Right, if they're not using skeletal muscle, right, blood can clot in their veins, and then if it ever starts to flow back to their heart, that can cause a stroke or a heart attack once again, or if it flows into their lungs, that causes a pulmonary embolism. And that's why you should always exercise. Even if you can't get up and really move around for 12 hours at a time, right, you still have to take time to do that. When might you be sitting down in a chair for maybe 12 or 16 hours and you can't get up and walk around? Maybe you're traveling in a car, yeah? Maybe you're traveling someplace that's far away. You should always stop, and you should exercise those muscles. That helps return blood to the heart, prevents that blood from clotting. How about if you hop on an airplane and go to Denpasar? Where's Denpasar? It's Indonesia. That's really far away. That's about as far away as you can get. You're on an airplane for 16 hours. What should you do during that flight? You get up and exercise a little bit, right? And there was a pretty famous case of a pulmonary embolism. There was a news reporter, pretty famous news reporter, maybe about 10 years ago, and he was reporting on some military activity in the Middle East, and he goes, I'm not going to get out of my armored vehicle because there's people shooting at me and throwing bombs and things like that. So he just stayed in his armored vehicle, didn't get up and walk around for a couple days, and he had a blood clot, and he died of a pulmonary embolism as a result of that, right? So this is really something you should think about, what the skeletal muscle pump. So kind of always goes back to why people really hate this class. What are the two reasons? Diet and exercise, right? And so here's another example of why exercise is good for you, because it helps return blood to the heart, helps prevent blood clots. Okay, I wanted to finish up with that. Okay, I just happened to see that figure. Pulmonary circulation is what we're getting to. All right, so here's the whole pulmonary circulation. You see it's a very small circuit, so it doesn't need a lot of pressure developed by the heart to pump blood through these organs, and so the right ventricle is really thin. And here is the pulmonary trunk, taking blood away from the heart. So the pulmonary trunk is what, an artery or a vein? Even though it's blue? Is that an artery? Is that an artery? Yes, you should tell me, even though I was trying to trick you, because blood is flowing away from the heart, even if it is blue, right? That's an artery. Pulmonary trunk is an artery. Then we see it bifurcating into the left and right pulmonary arteries, right? These are arteries taking blood to the lungs, and then all of a sudden, I see some blood vessels that are red. What does that mean? What happened? What's in between these blue vessels and red vessels right here? They're not shown on this diagram, but you know they're there because I see this change in color. Okay, the blue signifies relatively low oxygen. The red signifies relatively high oxygen. What happened to cause these blood vessels to change color like that? Yeah, exchange. So there are what kind of vessels? Yeah, there are capillaries. And if we look, zoom way into the lungs, right, I can see some pockets filled with air and that has high oxygen. And here I see a blood vessel and I see oxygen going from these pockets of air. These are what we call alveoli. Right? I see oxygen moving from an alveolus into the blood. And we know that's got to be a capillary. And indeed, you can look at it right here. I just see what? A simple squamous endothelium. Here's a capillary. So don't forget about those capillaries in there. All right, and then there are four pulmonary veins that bring blood back to the left atrium. So this is the whole pulmonary circulation. What do you got? Pulmonary artery, you got pulmonary capillaries, and pulmonary veins. That's the pulmonary circulation. And we'll talk about some of these other things about the lungs when we get into the lung chapter. So that's it for pulmonary circulation. Here is, okay, blood vessels all over your body. Is this pulmonary circulation? No, this is your systemic circulation. It has a little bit different pattern. It comes from the left ventricle, right, not the right ventricle, into the aorta. And then the aorta, right, conducts that blood to various parts of your body through various kinds of pathways. And I think next time we'll start to look at some of these things. In lab, we have to know a lot of them, but I want to point out a couple things for you. All right, and veins are not too difficult to understand because most veins are named by the artery that they course very close to. All right, so if you have an iliac artery, right in that area you have an iliac vein. All right, there's only a couple conditions where the names don't match up. Like the carotid artery and the jugular vein don't have the same name, but they're in the same location in the body. All right, so this is an exam figure, so you can go ahead and start looking at this one, and I'll talk about some details about the systemic circulation next time. All right, sign-in sheet is going around. So we just got to cover the circulation a little bit and also about a portal blood system. Oh, my microphone went off. I didn't even notice. Yeah. Is that red? No? It's green. No, it's on. All right, sorry. It increases blood pressure. Okay. It works by diffusion. So a compound, so a compound will move from high concentration to low. And what I want you to think about is water. Okay. When your body is really salty, there's low water concentration, and in your kidney, there's water at high concentration. Right? And so water will go from your kidney back into your body. And the reason why you have low concentration water in the body is because you've eaten a lot of salt. So if you eat a lot of salt, the water concentration goes down, and water then is drawn into your body by diffusion as a result of that.
Directly affects the heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Blood pressure directly affects the heart all kinds of different ways. Usually it makes the heart beat stronger, which produces hypertension. But if the heart is stressed like that for a long period of time, then it starts to die. It gets really weak. We call that cardiomyopathy. It can start to dilate when it's been working too hard for a long time. And when it starts to dilate, then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it stops working altogether. Because we have too much fluid in our body. So if somebody has a high salt diet, too much fluid in your body, your heart starts to fail, there's a really nice simple solution in the beginning if it's caught early enough. And that is to get rid of fluid in your body. And what kind of drug gets rid of fluid?
A diuretic,
right? So when somebody's in heart failure, okay, one of the first drugs we give somebody is a diuretic. They lose all of that fluid and their heart gets stronger. Kind of amazing how that happens. Yeah. Sure, office hours, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Don't need an appointment. But I plan to be here. Okay. Hi. Okay. So, what do you need to do? You need to do a lecture exam. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't know how you're feeling or anything like that, but when can you take this lecture exam? Sooner the better, because I don't want you to get behind in the class. Yeah, you got to start studying for the next one. Thank you. Yeah, I just leave that right there. I would say you have to do it by at least next week.
Okay.
After next week, that will be too late for you. Okay.
So I won't go to SI.
Yeah, that's too bad, but yeah.
And I'll just take a test after election.
Okay. You have lab today?
Yeah.
Okay, so then there's no conflict there.
Yeah.
Because I don't want you to miss lab.
Oh, no.
Okay. Okay, after lecture. And I'll have to figure out where I would like you to take the test. Maybe I'll have you take it at the testing center in the LLRC.
Where is that?
First floor. Just walk in the front door, and there's a counter right there. Just walk right up to the counter and say, I'm here to take a test.
Oh, okay.
But they will ask you for a Fullerton College or Cypress College ID.
Okay, I have that.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm.
And on the test, they'll put down how long you have, which is about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I'll put the deadline, like maybe on Wednesday or something.
Okay.
Okay. Because you're going to take it Monday.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then you just turn it into them, and then I'll say you have a eraser and a pencil, but no calculator, no notes,
mm-hmm.
no phone, any of that kind of stuff.
No.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, very well. So how are you doing? I forget. What did you have? Oh yeah. Okay.
It started from last week,
mm-hmm.
and it's just I couldn't keep anything in.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't even study, so that's kind of weird.
Yeah, when our digestive system works, it's you take. It for granted.
Yeah.
When it starts to misbehave, it's like
know.
A big, huge deal.
I know.
Oh, good. So I'm glad you're getting better.
Yeah, I feel a lot better today.
Okay.
Thank
good.
You so much.
Okay. Good. If you send me an email over the weekend and just remind me,
okay.
that would be okay with me. Yeah.
I'll do that.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, right now is good. Let me just put this back in the drawer before I forget. Uh-oh. I left my microphone on. All of these things are important to know. We've been talking about the vena cava.